this is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Jan Narveson, professor of philosophy at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada, and our topic is why we are not morally obliged to help feed the world starving. Jan, glad to have you on the show.
Glad to be here, Hugh.
You acknowledge that when most people think about starving children in the world, that we feel some compulsion, some urge to help them. But you think that it's a mistake to describe that as any kind of moral obligation. I wonder if you could sort of briefly explain what your view is, and then we'll look at the details of that view a little bit later in the show.
Okay. Now, the strongest notion of moral obligation, which perhaps might be called moral duty or what's required in the interest of justice, is the sort where the person can be actually compelled to do the thing, no matter whether he wants to or not, for example, by threats of incarceration or something of that sort. In a case like this, the people who have the contrary view to mine think that it's all right, for example, to tax people's money in order to support the starving. Now, in that strongest sense, I certainly deny that we've got this kind of an obligation. I think it's wrong for governments to tax people in order to do this, in order to just do this. Note that on occasion, I mean, we get into the complex subjects of politics there, of course, and I'll agree that on occasion, a government might have a special political interest in doing something like that. But we're talking about feeding the starving just for the sake of feeding the starving. And that's what I deny that governments may, or anybody may, require us to do. Now then, nextly, I certainly think it's morally praiseworthy, so far as it goes, to help out the starving, or indeed to help anybody do anything, for that matter. Rectifying starvation is, of course, usually more important. I mean, I presumably do somebody in the world more of a favor if I keep him from starving to death than if I, for example, help him tie his shoelaces or give him directions to the nearest subway. Nevertheless, all help goes in a big basket for me, and the degree to which you exemplify a moral virtue in this regard is the degree to which you are helpful to others. But is there a notion of moral obligation somewhere in between these two? Well, perhaps we could consider what I used to call, or still do call, verbal reinforcement, where people can, for instance, call people bad names. Now, we get into fine points here. I mean, somebody who doesn't do anything for the starving or anybody else like that is uncharitable. Is uncharitable a term of abuse? Perhaps the person who is not charitable doesn't think so, in which case that's fine. But others of us might think, well, you know, he really should be doing something after all. I mean, supposing he can afford it or whatever. And so I'm ready to say of people like that, well, they're not being as virtuous as they could be and should be, but that's different from saying that they have an outright moral obligation to do so in any very strong sense of the term. So my short answer is that I think that things like helping the starving are voluntary. Apart from the special cases, I mean, if you are in a community where the people right next door are starving and you all share in the general problem and the general fate, then I think you've got a pretty strong duty to help, just as you would if there were a hurricane or something like that.
Okay, so the first thing is by obligation. You primarily think of obligation as something that individuals can be coerced to do,
right?
And the coercion is not just verbal coercion. It's not just shunning. It usually what you're talking about then is the force, the law.
Yep.
That something is an obligation if it's something which the law can force you to do.
Right. Notice, however, that it is not confined to law, because you know you could personally compel somebody. I mean, I could hold you up at gunpoint as a privateer and say, you know, contribute to Oxfam or else. Now, I mean, this doesn't normally happen.
Right.
But the point is it could, and that would be wrong, too.
So the main thing you're concerned about is anything that requires, or excuse me, coerces a person to help.
Essentially, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
But you're not opposed. Indeed, it's not only that you're not opposed to it, you actually think that it's a laudable thing to
right.
do, that it's something that we can encourage other people to do,
right.
and perhaps also that we can criticize them if they don't do it, at least in the sense that we can, you know, your words were that we can call them uncharitable, perhaps we could call them stingy, tight-fisted,
right.
inconsiderate, and so on, and all those things would in your view, be appropriate to do.
Yes.
What's not appropriate is saying, and if you don't do it, we'll punish you in some way.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All righty. Well, now, let's go at it the other way. What is it that makes, I mean, maybe this seems obvious to people, but perhaps it'd be important for understanding your view to articulate it. What is it that makes it commendable that we help people
okay.
in these conditions?
To answer that properly, I need to expound, you know, a little bit more of what I think to be the fundamental basis of morality. And, I mean, although that's, in principle, a very large job, you can say a couple of useful things in a couple of minutes, so that's what I'll do. So the short version is that, in my view, morals is a bunch of social rules, and the social rules come from the very people whose behavior is governed by those rules. This is really Kantian in a way, although Kant brings up sort of metaphysical overtones that I don't want imported into this at all. But what we've got here is we've got a whole bunch of people who come in touch with each other, more or less, who have something to do with each other, and whose actions in particular can affect each other. So if we ask, well, how do we go about generating a set of social rules that make sense to people? The answer is that we look at the social rules from the point of view of every individual, and we ask, okay, from that particular individual's point of view, given his interests, which may or may not be confined to self-interest, and I think they usually aren't, but on the other hand, very few people are universally altruistic just by nature. So we've got all these people who range from the very selfish to the normally and limitedly altruistic and sympathetic to a few people of great sort of natural generosity. And the question is, what are the rules to impose on all these people? I mean, what are the sort of social mores that we should be establishing as rational beings? Now, we need here, in my view, a universal agreement. I mean, we're looking for the rules that everybody would agree to. And on that point, it seems to me that we would restrict coercion to defense, just as it does in all the great liberty principles that we get from Hobbes, Locke, Kant, and Mill, and for that matter, Gautier, though he doesn't really realize it. But this is the general rule that the use of force is to be confined to protecting yourself or other people who voluntarily enlist your protective assistance from the coercive activities of others. So the first principle of morals is to make peace on everybody, is to proscribe war, absolutely. Now, this is not going to get us an obligation to help people in need, because need certainly gives the person in need a reason to do something, but it doesn't give anybody else a reason to do something unless they happen to be sympathetic or unless they are related to that person in some kind of mutually interdependent way, such that an obligation to help is part of that kind of deal. But that's not a universal deal. That's a rather local kind of thing. So as far as the universal principle is concerned, it seems to me that the non-harm principle is the only one that everybody has a clear rational interest in subscribing to. Now, on the other hand, when we come to principles that are not strictly of obligation, but of sometimes called supererogation, where we're going beyond our duty, then consider, moral praise doesn't cost anything. I mean, the person who issues the praise isn't put out much of any for doing it. It's cheap. And people helping other people benefits somebody. That person has an interest in being helped, and he has an interest in being a part of a society, part of a social group, or indeed living under general social rules, which encourage that kind of thing. So the point about considering charity to be a moral virtue and something that we should praise people for is that it's a win-win situation. I mean, nobody loses and lots of people win. Probably we all win in the end, in my opinion. Not just my opinion. I mean, it gets pretty clear that all of us stand to benefit from the general disposition on the part of the people around us to be at least moderately helpful. And so we have, you know, good reason to hold that up as a good model of human conduct.
Okay, there you've really raised a number of important points, of which I hope we have a time to cover in the remainder of the show. Let me go back. It's actually one thing you said very earlier, and then it was also a comment you made in that answer. You said something about that aiding other people is voluntary, except perhaps if they're next door, that maybe under those circumstances we have some kind of obligation to assist. And in the last answer you said something about mutual interdependence. Yeah. I wonder if you could explain that. What is it about the people next door that might actually give us an obligation that we don't have to people at a distance?
Right. Well, first the answer has to be close relations which are two-way, not just one-way. Do my neighbors do things for me? Yes, I benefit from their assistance frequently. Suppose the answer is yes. Now, if it's no, then this isn't going to apply. I mean, it only applies where there's interaction of a kind that creates not exactly dependency, but a pattern of reliability, of being able to count on the other person's help at various times when help is highly desirable to you. When that's the case, then we've got something like a kind of voluntary corporation is the wrong word here, but we've got an interactive group where there's interdependence. Another pretty good example is a family. The children in a family certainly don't contract with their parents to be helpful and so on, but the parents do, in fact, do a great deal for the children, and the children should have an attitude of, yes, I should be doing things for them. And you do get to say, Johnny, take out the garbage, and expect him to do it, and so forth. So, and I think that when we've got that kind of sort of close interdependence, then we've got a basis for saying, yes, there's an obligation of quite a bit stronger sort than exists between me, for example, and the average North Korean, say.
So the issue is really one of reciprocity or of tit for tat.
Not closeness, just per se. It's really reciprocity.
Okay, so it's
It would be possible to have obligations to somebody in New Zealand whom you've had a long email correspondence with, right?
Okay.
Okay.
So the idea is that if you have an arrangement where you either get or at least have reason to expect that you would get aid from that person, then those would be circumstances under which you might have an obligation to give aid to them.
Yeah.
And would that be an obligation in the strongest sense that it could be enforced by the state?
Yeah, it could, but only when, you know, that's where we get into, for example, starvation. I mean, if my neighbor is actually starving, then I certainly ought to do something for him. If there's no obvious other way in which he can make ends meet, then I'm going to help him, and I ought to. And in a case where, for example, he has saved my life recently, then I would certainly have a very strong obligation to do this.
All right. I want to pursue a number of these themes in the second half of the show. I'd like to pause just for a moment. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Jan Narveson, professor of philosophy at the University of Waterloo in Canada, and we're discussing why we're not morally obligated to help the starving, the world starving.
Uh-huh.
One way, and I'm trying to find out if this is really a fair way of capturing your view, and maybe you can clarify this. You have talked about rules and obligations and duties. On the other hand, you've talked quite a bit about virtues, what the virtuous person to do would do, should do, what the appropriately charitable person would do. What is the best way for us to think about the way we ought to treat other people? I mean, is it that we need to be using the language of obligations or duties, or are we somehow missing something, and should we be perhaps emphasizing talk of virtues, developing the right kind of character? On your view, what's the best way to think about our responsibilities to others?
Now, on there's a general philosophical issue in the field of moral philosophy, as you know, between virtue theorists and rule theorists. I think these are very coordinate myself. I think that rules, in a kind of small R sense of the term, come first, and that you know, virtues are understandable in relation to those rule-like kind of things. A virtuous person is someone who does the sort of things he ought to do, and those are the things that are encapsulated in little maxims and rules and principles. Or big ones, as the case may be. But some rules leave a lot more sort of a latitude for individual choice than others. I mean, nobody has a choice about, I mean, a moral choice, but whether to murder somebody. This is something that you are not to do, period. And you don't get praised for refraining from murder. You get blamed, and worse than blamed, for murdering somebody. On the other hand, there are lots and lots of other things where there's a great deal more latitude in the specific occasion, as both Mill and Kant have pointed out, and also where there's a great deal more reasonable variability from one person to another. Some people just are more helpful than others. By nature, they like helping other people more. Some people are situated in such a way that they can't really be of terribly much help to others, and so on and so on. All these things need to be taken into account, and you know, we hold up in esteem the person who, given all of his various circumstances, does well along these dimensions, and in lesser esteem the people who do less well. And I think, you know, estimability is in the sort of virtue box here. So the rule-like things, the things that say you should do such and such, or you're required to do so and so and so forth, those are the things that establish the dimensions along which we'll construct models of virtue.
Okay. Let me also go back and try to pick up on one other theme, and maybe you could explain this a little bit for the listener. We're trying to give a brief snapshot, and of course part of the problem here is we don't have that much time, but a brief snapshot of the overarching moral view you have, that obligations arise primarily out of this rational agreement, the kind of agreement in which each person looks at, thinks about what kind of options, what kind of constraints they would want to have in their lives. And that the one thing that emerges is that we not harm other people, and that's the principal consideration.
Well, so, it's the first consideration. Principle introduces a slightly different dimension.
Okay.
Because we could say, well, look, all of us are in this for the general ultimate purpose of making our lives better, and that doesn't, on the first instance, sound like obligation in my strong sense. I mean, the goal of making your life better is not a moral goal. It's simply a goal. It's what we want to do. Now, we've got different views about what makes our life better, and that's terribly important here. I'm saying one of the things that we need in order to make our life better is morality. We need a set of principles that go across personal boundaries. Rules for the group, and in the ultimate run, rules for the whole group, the group of all of mankind. Now, we get into these rules because we expect to do better, given these rules, than not. And so the specific question for obligation is, when can we expect to do better despite making ourselves possibly liable to harms from other people? And the answer is only when the purpose of this is to prevent harms to others. I benefit from this. I mean, I benefit from other people not harming me. And in order to have it the case that others don't harm me, I've got to have the disposition not to harm them. That's what I owe them as part of what makes it a reasonable bargain from their point of view. So this is a component of an overall effort to promote the good life, or as some theorists put it, to maximize your utility.
How does this agreement go, though? Because one at least question which someone might wonder is the idea, if you and I are in roughly the same shape in terms of our income, in terms of our wealth, in terms of our general condition, then it's clear that we're both better off if we don't harm each other. That's perhaps the most important thing that we do. On the other hand, if I am much worse off than you are, financially, in terms of options, then it may be that what I really need is something quite a bit more than that you not harm me. Maybe what I need is that you help me.
That may be what you need, but it doesn't follow that you have good reason to expect me to agree with a rule that would require me to give it to you. And notice that, I mean, this is a common fallacy along this front. We all have our lives to lose, the poor as well as the rich. And if the poor are saying, here, look, I mean, we're so poor that the rule against harm should be suspended in our case, the reply to that is, you know, rich people, if anything, are quite a bit more capable of depriving the poorest people of things that they value, notably their lives, than our poor ones come to that. I mean, if you want to have a war between the rich and the poor, well, good chance the rich are going to win this one. Or at least there's no particular reason to think that they're going to lose and that the poor are going to come out of this war with a big advantage. They're not. Quite the contrary.
Though I suppose they might say we also don't have much to lose either, whereas the rich presumably do have quite a bit to lose.
They have their lives to lose. I mean, anybody, no matter how badly off you are, you can be made worse off by somebody's intervention.
Well, it seems to me that is one of the interesting questions, is if you are in bad enough shape, is death
My only point
worse.
Is you can't expect me to agree to allow you to threaten me with violence in order to bring it about that you get what you need.
Okay.
You do a lot better by just asking for it, by the way. I mean, as a matter of fact, people around the world, right down through recorded history, have been remarkably generous in any kind of tolerable circumstances. That is to say, people do help each other, and for good reason. I mean, it's a good thing to help other people. We all agree with this, the rich and the poor. Why shouldn't we? You know, and when if we can do it easily, well, shucks, why not? But it's one thing to say that, and quite another thing to say, and you get to kick me in the teeth if I don't.
Okay.
Sorry, you don't.
All right. Let me to sort of round out. I realize we just got a little over 4 minutes here. One of the things that might help kind of round out the account of your view is you talk about three principles. You talk about the golden rule, the silver rule, and the leaden rule.
Yes.
Maybe you could explain what those rules are, and perhaps even tie it in with an explanation of how you might view the role of moral education. I mean, what ought parents to tell their children when they're trying to explain to them or talk to them about what morality requires?
Hmm. Okay. The golden rule says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And it just stops there, which pretty well means that no matter what other people do to us, we should be really nice to them. I don't buy that. I think very few people do, strictly. The leaden rule says, do to others what they do to you. this is a recipe for a protracted war in many cases. The silver rule says, roughly speaking, be as helpful to others as you can reasonably expect them to be so to you, and be ready to start the ball rolling by being the first one to do the other person a good turn. So that's like the tit-for-tat rule as expounded by, what's his name, which we all know and which I can never remember, which says, you know, in a prisoner's dilemma situation, start out by cooperating, and then only if the other guy responds by defecting do you in turn resort to defection. That seems to me to be essentially right. So we should presume goodwill on the part of others and act accordingly, but if we find that they don't have goodwill, we certainly don't have to keep on doing it.
And basically that's the kind of advice or mentoring that we ought to be giving our children.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
Okay. All right. It may be in the last minute and a half, if there's some final point you'd like to make for the listener, please proceed.
First, just a general caveat. As I say, there could be very special political type reasons for helping some people in some situations. Today, for example, there's probably an exceptionally good reason for being exceptionally helpful to the Afghanistan people as opposed to their horrible government. Secondly, I have not pointed out, but I must point out, that if it's the case that the reason why those other people are starving is something we've done, then of course we owe them assistance because we owe them compensation. Now, I think there are very few cases of that, but many people hold that there are lots of cases of that, and that needs to be sorted out empirically. I mean, I think that generally speaking, the reasons people give for supposing that it's our fault, for example, the people who think that people in Latin America are poor because of the activities of American or multinational corporations and so on, well, I mean, I think that empirically is all wet. But I mean, if it weren't, then of course it would indeed give you a good reason for insisting on a stronger level of aid, and possibly one that can be extracted. So I'm not saying that there are no circumstances in which we can be required to do good to others. I am saying, though, that insofar as it's just a question of giving help, no other factors taken into consideration, that so far as it goes, not harming is the required kind of behavior, the rule of obligation, and helping is the rule of merit or virtue.
Okay, well, thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
Okay, glad to have been on it, Hugh.
I've been speaking today with Jan Narveson, professor of philosophy at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada. This is Hugh Follett for Ideas and Issues. Good day.